You're listening to the brand new podcast from the University of Manchester's Policy at Manchester team. I'm Chris Peters, your host, and today it's Clean Air Day. So we're talking pollution with guest Grant Allen.
I'm a professor of atmospheric physics at the University of Manchester, and my research is into the quantification of greenhouse gas emissions from various sources, both natural and man-made. So I work with aircraft and drones and fixed site monitoring measurement methods to try and quantify emissions using measurement.
So first question, quite keen to talk about the UK's energy mix and the trade-offs that are kind of implicit around energy and air quality. So perhaps you could talk to us a bit about fracking and what impact fracking is likely to have with regards to air quality.
So fracking is touted as what's called a bridge fuel. So it's part of the pathway towards a cleaner energy future. So the argument is that fracking or hydraulic fracturing can be cleaner in terms of its impact on the environment and in terms of greenhouse gas emissions per kilowatt hour of energy generated compared to coal. So the justification for its use as a bridge fuel is that it can be cleaner than coal and our pathway to a cleaner net zero energy future. The impacts that it's thought that it could have on the environment in the UK concern air quality, so emissions of things like nitrogen dioxide, particulate matter, greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane, so the carbon dioxide from burning the fuel, and methane from leaks, essentially. We call them fugitive emissions. Sometimes these are unwanted and sometimes they are controlled. And there are other environmental risks as well, like potential contamination of groundwater, the water that we use for resource in the UK. Seismic hazard is quite an important public concern. And other impacts that are more local, such as road traffic, etc.
So in terms of a comparison there between those sorts of impacts, the kind of local emissions from presumably trucks going to and from sites, you know, the setting up of the sites, how does that compare to the kind of the fugitive emissions in terms of air quality, both locally but also nationally?
So the air quality issue is both local and regional. So a lot of some studies that have been done in the United States, for example, on the well-developed shale gas industry that's really rocketed in the United States since 2006, have shown that the emissions of nitrogen dioxide and volatile organic compounds, so other unburnt hydrocarbons, those can interact in the atmosphere in the presence of sunlight to influence ozone chemistry. So that can lead to what we call secondary ozone formation, or the chemistry of the formation of ozone, which can impact cities downwind. So some areas in Texas, for example, have seen wintertime episodes of increased ozone concentration that you wouldn't normally expect to see. And that's been directly attributed to the emissions from the fracking industry in the area. So in the United Kingdom, it's a similar sort of question there. What are the impacts downwind? What's the secondary production of these compounds that affect air quality, especially if plumes of these emissions interact with the chemistry in the urban environment? So Manchester is obviously very nearby to Blackpool, the UK's first shale gas well. So there's a question there on how it might impact air quality more regionally. But more locally, we're probably more concerned with the environment within about 10 kilometres of a shale gas well, in terms of what the exposure of the local population might be to nitrogen dioxide that's produced in the flare stacks when they burn excess methane on site, and possibly the emissions of what we call air toxics, so things like hydrogen sulfide. And all of those things are things that we monitor. So at the University of Manchester, we run an air quality and greenhouse gas monitoring site at Blackpool, which is about 400 metres away from the shale gas site, on the same land that the shale gas site is on. So that's an independent academic project funded by BEIS, and that sits alongside the more sort of regulatory monitoring that's done by the Environment Agency. So it's fair to say that there's a lot of monitoring going on to try and assess these impacts in the UK context and compare that to these studies that have been done in the US environment, which is potentially different.
So it's Clean Air Day today. What can we do to try and mitigate some of the impacts of the pollutants that are being put into our atmosphere?
Potentially, there's some very clever solutions to this, which really need to be thought through. But one of the ideas that we've been toying with is that, and this is based on the science that's been done in the United States on air quality downwind in cities, is if you choose the time and the day that you do certain activities at fracking sites, you can actually reduce the impact on air quality downwind. So, for example, if you were to only flare at these sites on days when there's a strong westerly wind and it's cloudy, then it means that that nitrogen dioxide and any volatile organic compounds that might be emitted from the flare stack don't then have the ability to react in the atmosphere and produce ozone and other things downwind. So you can actually reduce those regional impacts especially, and the local impacts as well, of course, if it's a bit more windy, as opposed to what we want out of this summer, a lovely sunny high pressure system to come in when the air is very stable and the winds are very slight, when anything you're emitting then is going to hang about in the atmosphere and react. So you can offset some of these air quality impacts by smart industrial practices. So that's something that we're trying to explore from a modelling perspective, to think about, is there something smarter that we can do to mitigate the impacts?
So the differences between the US and the UK, is that down to kind of, you know, the geology in the area, or the kind of the use of the machinery and the tools and the practice involved?
It's a bit of everything, really. So in the United States, the regulatory framework wasn't really as well developed because it was an untested industry. So a lot of the approaches to handling regulation in the United States were quite slow to develop. So in the UK, there's very strict and thorough regulatory framework. So, for example, the regulators impose a triple well casing design for the well, the bores that are drilled down into the shale formations. So those consist of cement and steel, and they're designed to stop leaks of frack fluid or produced gas into the groundwater, into those water near surface reservoirs. So that's a triple well case down through the aquifer. And as well as that, there's the Health and Safety Executive, the Environment Agency, the Oil and Gas Authority are all regulators that are involved in monitoring the potential impact of this. And our academic work feeds into that regulatory discussion on what that needs to be going forward if and when the UK shale gas industry were to scale up.
And so, I mean, I know that the fugitive emissions in the US is a kind of area of contention because the estimates for that vary quite widely between, I don't know if that's between sites or whether it's between kind of monitoring stations. Is that something that we can expect here, or is this research and this monitoring trying to kind of remove some of that uncertainty?
That's a good question. So there are thousands of wellheads in the US, of course, and they've been monitored by the regulators there and academics in the States that have tried to quantify what the percentage emission is of methane as a percent of the methane that's produced and used in the grid there. So the range of values there is broadly in the range of 0.5 to 12% plus of produced gas. The average sits somewhere just under 2%, and that number of 2% is actually critical because around about 2% fugitive emission of methane is the carbon equivalent with coal. So it's really important for the shale gas industry to get well under that 2% number, because that really justifies the claim that it can be cleaner than coal as a bridge fuel. But the range of uncertainty on those numbers is still large even in the US, so there's potential there. The jury's still out, really, on whether it is cleaner than coal on carbon grounds, if you ignore these other hazards, seismic, air quality, etc. But on greenhouse gases, the jury's very much still out. And in the UK, it's just too early to say. We've only got one site to monitor. We did detect some emissions of methane from the site in January this year. That was publicly reported on. There's a report that we can probably link to on this podcast for people to read about, hosted by the British Geological Survey, where we did measure emissions of methane that was supposed to be burnt in the flare stack on site, but the pressure was too low and they couldn't ignite the flare to burn this methane and to convert it to carbon dioxide. And it was instead what we call cold vented. So we wouldn't call that fugitive emissions because it's a controlled leak. So it's a controlled venting of methane through the stack. And that was reported by Quadrilla to the Environment Agency. So there's a question there about how you effectively flare this excess gas, because it's better to flare it than to release methane into the atmosphere, because methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, about 27 times more potent in terms of radiative forcing, molecule for molecule.
So it's a more powerful greenhouse gas, so it kind of it contributes more to the kind of global warming effect as a result compared to carbon dioxide, is that what I'm saying?
Yes, that's right. So the methane eventually is oxidized in the atmosphere to carbon dioxide, but it has a lifetime of around about 10 years. So it's gradually converted to carbon dioxide, but while it's in its methane form, it's 27 times more effective at trapping infrared radiation molecule for molecule compared to carbon dioxide. And one of the big worries in my field in climate science at the moment is that methane is rising very rapidly. So since 2006, it's been rising by a few parts per billion per year, and that looks to be accelerating. And a lot of the science that we're doing at the moment is trying to assess the causes for that rise. There are lots of competing theories for this, that it could be an increase in the feedbacks in the natural system. So we've done projects with aircraft field campaigns in Africa, in the Arctic, around the UK, trying to quantify the emissions from these different natural sources, and sure enough they are strong, and there are papers that suggest that this biogenic feedback, that we call it, this the warming feeding the warming. So as the climate warms, especially in the tropics, microbes are more efficient at converting organic matter into methane. So there's one school of thought that it's that that budget that's increasing, that's explaining the rise. And there's lots of other studies, especially out of the States, that suggest it's what we call thermogenic emissions. These are the type of emissions linked to fossil fuels. Other theories surround the sinks of methane in the atmosphere. So is the methane lifetime changing as a result of changing in the atmosphere's ability to cleanse itself? So the atmosphere cleanses itself using a bleach, essentially. It's called the hydroxyl radical, and that's the thing that removes all the pollutants from the atmosphere over time. It's a very highly reactive molecule, and there's a lot of active research going on into whether or not the budget of the hydroxyl radical, the budget of the atmosphere's ability to cleanse itself, is starting to decrease, which increases the lifetime of pollutants like methane, for example. We know that we're emitting more methane into the atmosphere globally in terms of man-made emissions, and we're pretty confident that biogenic emissions are increasing as well. So the explanation for that increase in methane is probably a mix of all of these competing effects.
So my question is about hydroxyl. Is there something we can do to put more of that in the atmosphere to kind of help with that bleaching, or is that bordering on the realms of science fiction?
Yes, it is, really. I think the hydroxyl radical is created by photolysis of water vapor in the atmosphere. So ultraviolet radiation from the sun splits water and produces hydroxyl. That's a very simplistic explanation of it. And that chemical pathway is modulated by all of the concentrations of the different pollutants in the atmosphere. So we use proxies. It's very, very hard actually to measure the concentration of the hydroxyl radical directly in the atmosphere. We often infer it from other measurements to try and calculate its budget and its lifetime against other gases. So no, it's a very natural process. And one of the ideas is that because the tropics is becoming warmer with climate change, there's more cloud, and that limits the production rate of the hydroxyl radical. So it's fair to say that in the UK we're world leading on the approaches to monitoring and the approaches to best practice and regulation, and I think a lot of countries are looking to try and adopt what we're doing, and that's feeding back to the US as well.
And if it's the case that the research here, the monitoring here, shows that in fact fugitive emissions are higher than this kind of 2% cutoff point, that would significantly weaken the argument for fracking as a bridging fuel. Is that right?
Yes, I think it would. So the Paris Agreement, of course, commits us to reducing our greenhouse gas emissions quite strictly. By any measure, you know, adding a new industry that emits greenhouse gases into the atmosphere is at odds with what our future Paris targets are. But the flip side to that is that we need to be sustainable in our energy, and the demand is increasing. So we need to have energy sustainability as well. So if really there's a trade-off here between the scale and pace of development of renewable energy technologies in the energy industry, and we need to meet demand while that happens. So yes, those emissions put us at odds with our Paris Agreement targets, but there's a bigger picture here that we need to keep in mind.
So that's all we've got time for today. Thanks to Professor Grant Allen for his time today. If you've got questions following from this interview, do please get in touch and we'll put those questions to the researchers. For more information about our energy and environment research, go to manchester.ac.uk/energy-research, or you can search online for the University of Manchester's research beacons. Join us next time when we'll dissect another topical topic from a policy perspective.